Welcome to the Unteachables podcast. I'm your host, Claire, and I am absolutely no stranger to the challenges and, let's face it, sometimes carnage of being a teacher. And if you found yourself here listening with me, I'd say that you might know a bit about that as well. Because being a teacher is friggin' hard, and this podcast is dedicated to making you feel a hell of a lot less alone whilst giving you the knowledge, support, and strategies that you need to not just survive the chaos of being a teacher, but truly thrive. Think about it as getting a weekly dose of relatable, actionable, and most importantly, enjoyable professional learning straight into your ears. So hit the subscribe button, download me for your commute, and let's get into it. Well, hello there. Another week, another episode of the Unteachables podcast. And this episode I am high key absolutely in love with because I speak to the incredible Robin Goble. And when I say you want to listen to this episode, I mean it. Listen to this episode if you had one episode of the Unteachables podcast to listen to, because Robin is just a fountain of knowledge and she's just an incredible human being. She's a former therapist and she's just turned into an author. She just released her first book and all of the information you'll hear throughout the podcast. She's also a podcaster, a fellow podcaster. So that was really fun to be able to chat with her. She is an educator. She's a community creator. And her work is really around supporting the grown-ups, whether it's the parents, the teachers, the therapists, anybody who works with these kids, but anybody who works with these kids with vulnerable nervous systems and what she calls big baffling behaviors. And she takes a relational neuroscience approach and she really wants to understand and dig deep into what behavior really is. So everything that we want to learn as teachers, she's got that in spades. And this episode, we dive into two concepts that really flip the way that we see big baffling behaviors in our classrooms, as well as revealing some really fundamental problems with how we work with our students with trauma in the education system. It really reveals what we need to be doing differently and what we can't do with the current system. And as well as that, one of the biggest challenges that you have as teachers, and I get it, is working with challenging parents. And Robin also delves into that. She really is that good. This episode is full of information that every human being needs just to be more compassionate and bring more kindness to ourselves and others in the world. So enjoy the episode. I can't wait for you to hear it. Robin, thank you so much for being here with me today. I know that it's hard to line things up, but you were able to do this so incredibly quickly. I gave you the word and you were like, yep, let's do this.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I mean, it was just like the perfect timing where I had all this kind of like blank space in my calendar. So it's working out great.
You are all about the big baffling behaviors. So yes, to be able to bring you onto my podcast where people listen because of the big baffling behaviors, you are just a fountain of knowledge in what you do. And I've been following you for a little while now, and I'm a little bit of a fangirl for your work. And you've got, I know you're going to talk about it later, but you've got a book that's just come out and I got a bit emotional because I saw your post where you were like, you had the box in front of you and you're like, I don't want to open it, Dizzy. I just want to like savor this moment. How does it feel getting a book out there?
Oh my gosh. Unbelievable. Like it's still hard to even put into words. And I did, I had this very like, a big awareness. It's like, I'm never going to open my first box of books ever again. Like as soon as I do this, it's going to be over.
Just congratulations. I know blood, sweat, and tears that go into that process. I don't know if you know, I'm in the middle of that process at the moment. And like the sacrifice and all of the things. And I can see that book sitting behind you at the moment. And yeah, you should just be so proud of that. And I can't wait to read it myself. Like I'd love to get myself a copy and read that because I know that it's going to be hopefully not too relevant for my baby, but I have a feeling that I'm going to come across some baffling behaviors with her as well.
Yes. We usually do, don't we?
Yeah. Well, I guess not to waste anybody's time, I want to kick into what you do in your work. So if you were to give me an elevator pitch, or everyone on my podcast, an elevator pitch of what you do, what you're all about, what your understanding and approach is to behavior, what kind of things might you tell us?
Yeah. So I'm a former play therapist. And when I went into the field, I mean, when I was a teenager still, I always wanted to work with kids with the most out of control behaviors. And I started actually doing that and realized I had absolutely no idea what I was doing at all. I mean, I thought I did, but I did not. In fact, I was getting hurt at work and I was an outpatient therapist. I wasn't working like in an inpatient hospital where, yeah, maybe sometimes you get hurt by your patients. So I was just driven to figure out like what on earth is going on with these kids. Like these behaviors just don't make any sense. I have no idea what I'm doing. And I hated how that felt, but there was also nowhere else to send these kids. So I just got kind of obsessively curious about trying to figure out, you know, like what behavior really is. And I came into the field, I think, in a really luxurious time in which we were learning so quickly about the brain and the nervous system. We were learning so much about behavior that had previously been really unknown. So I took everything that I had just the great good fortune to learn about what behavior really is, translated that to my work with kids and their families in the therapy office. And about 4 years ago, I stepped away from doing individual one-on-one therapy to be able to focus on helping people in like this bigger, broader way with, you know, education and courses and teaching and training and podcasting and writing books.
That's brilliant. And when I hear you talk about stepping into the field, wanting, like you've driven by this why, but how the hell do you actually do this? Because the behaviors are so intense. Yes. There is like, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but we ourselves are so on edge and so dysregulated because there's so much happening around us and it just makes it near impossible to work with. And props to you for just going out there and figuring it out because there aren't a lot of places that you can go. Yeah. And you've become that place for people. Like you've created a space that you probably needed when you were first starting out and when I first started out. And you know, like it's just amazing to have that resource now and to have a book like yours and to have the work that you do. And one of the things that really catches my eye with your work, I love the way you frame things. I think that we're really aligned with the types of things that we believe in terms of behavior, education, parenting, all of those things with children. But one of the things that really catches my eye is your concept on connection or protection. I just think it's brilliant. I read that post and I was just like wanting to jump up and say, yes, yes, yes. Like, that's amazing. Can you just explain what connection or protection means?
I would love to. It is really like the core of the work that I do and borrowing largely from Dr. Porges's work with polyvagal theory and how he has introduced his idea of neuroception, which is this way that it's kind of like the spidey sense that we have, like without thinking about it, our brain and body and nervous system are just constantly, literally continuously assessing, am I safe or am I not safe? And it really is that binary. It's one or the other. We're either taking in all this information and go like, okay, yep, I guess I'm safe. Or it's not safe. There's not really an in the middle. So I kind of look at it as thinking about like the light switch in our kitchen. It's either on or off. Now, once it's on into like, uh-oh, there's danger. I think I'm not safe. It's like a dimmer switch. Like there's different levels of how not safe do I feel, but it's really that binary. I'm either feeling safe or I'm feeling not safe. Taking then, pulling even back even further, again, looking at a lot of Dr. Porges's work, relational neuroscience work in general, like Dr. Siegel's work, attachment theory, and what we can see, like a very broad summary, is that when we're feeling safe, our nervous system rests into what I now call connection mode. We're open and available for connection. Connections are default. We want connection. We're behaving in a way that's inviting connection, right? And if our nervous system is falling in the not safe mode, we shift into a state of protection. And so our primary focus then becomes, how do I protect myself? How do I stay safe? How do I return to safety? Because we're always, always, always trying to return to the state of safety so that we can fall back into connection mode. Connection mode is definitely like our preference. It's our default. We're always trying to get back there. But if we're feeling unsafe, even slightly, our nervous system is going to turn into this state of protection. And then behaviors emerge from one of those two places, either from a nervous system that is resting into connection or a nervous system that is focused on protection.
That was a brilliant explanation. And I've got all of these things kind of ruminating through my head as you're talking. And yeah. I know that you're not, you know, pitching to teachers and that's not your thing, but I think it's so relevant to everybody what you're talking about, because it is just a human thing. It relates to us. It relates to kids. It relates to everybody.
Yep.
Just say a student's in a class and their behaviors aren't necessarily conducive to learning, but they're still connecting with their peers. Would you say they're still in connection mode, or are they in protection mode because their behaviors are still challenging to the teacher? I know that's, I hope that makes sense, that kind of question, but that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking of at the moment, if it's very binary.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. It really truly could go either way. We're going to look at one, what are the behaviors? Although I don't get too wrapped up in the actual observable behavior. I like to think of behaviors as just like a cue or a clue, right? So who is that student, like, determining is the most important person to be in alignment with in that moment, right? Like, do they need to be in connection with the teacher, in which we are then going to see the kinds of behaviors and age appropriate behaviors, you know, like, please, 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 of course, like a 4-year old's, you know, behaviors when they're in connection mode in the classroom are wildly different than like, I have a 17-year-old, right, who can sit at his desk and work independently and, you know, do all those kinds of things. And of course, 4-year olds are not doing. So we have to hold that all into context. But so it is neuroception and who is, how we're feeling safe or not safe. Part of what's that we're taking into consideration is who is, what's the state of the nervous system of the person I'm in relationship with, and kind of who am I orienting to at this moment? Super appropriate for students in the classroom to sometimes be prioritizing their relationship with their peers, right? Mm-hmm. Now, again, I recognize that that's challenging for the teacher, but that is really developmentally appropriate, that sometimes students, for a wide variety of reasons, are much more interested in connecting with their peers than they are in, you know, following the appropriate expectations for the classroom.
And what I like about that is I always get questions around, because I do a lot of work with teachers about, you know, they're not feeling safe. They're in fight, flight or freeze mode. You know, they're downstairs and upstairs, brains disconnected. But there's kind of like two camps of behavior that I talk about. I talk about that quite generally. And then I'm like, hang on a second. No, there are other behaviors as well that don't necessarily relate to feeling unsafe. It's because they're trying to meet their need for connection with their peers, or they're trying to meet their need for fun. And there are all of these other things that drive behavior. So I guess there's kind of two camps about big baffling behaviors, where the one that are dysregulated and the ones that are just kind of trying to be needs meeting, in a sense. When I talk to teachers about like the lack of safety in a classroom, and you say they're either in connection or protection modes, what also comes to my mind is everything we do in a classroom setting, or what we should be doing, is trying to create a sense of felt safety for our students, right? Is it possible for us, and I'm sure there's like so many different nuances to this, but we're trying to line up all of these things to help students feel safe. Is it possible for us to actually create an environment for students who are super dysregulated to feel safe? Or is it just that they're going to be in that protection mode? Are they going to be able to be pulled out of that from, like, by us if they're in a really dysregulated state?
I love this question, because I do think, at least in sort of my pocket of the universe, where I'm mostly talking to parents and clinicians, therapists, that we have mostly, I think, unintentionally sort of sold this lie that as the grownups, if we just do everything right, we can, you know, make sure other people feel safe. So what that ends up leading to is a bunch of grownups with a bunch of dysregulated kids who feel like absolute failures, right? So the reality when it comes to felt safety in the nervous system and neuroception is that I'm responsible for offering safety, the person that I'm with gets to choose, and not consciously, but their nervous system, based on a whole lot of factors, gets to determine if it's safe to receive my offerings of safety. And felt safety comes from a wide variety of places. It comes from the relationship of with the person that we're with. It comes from what's happening in our inner world, and it comes from what's happening in our environment. And my area of expertise is kids with complex trauma. You know, like in their memory networks, in their neurobiology, and all of these very complicated places, kids are holding onto a felt sense of not being safe. And it isn't reasonable to think that I, as this, as their parent or as their teacher or as their therapist, have control over shifting that. What I have control over is, am I offering, am I creating an experience of felt safety based on the state of my own nervous system, based on the things I can control, like based on this environment? You know, like I was a therapist, so I spent a lot of time thinking about what is my office, you know, how is my office creating a sense of safety? And then kind of basic things like, you know, when I think about kids' internal sense of felt safety, I'm thinking about like, is this child hungry? Like, do they need a snack or a nap or a drink of water? Do they need to move their body? Like, there are some things as the grown-up in charge that I can kind of be responsible for with offering safety. But then there are so many things that are happening inside the child's own nervous system, in their memory networks, and, you know, things that I can make offerings of, but I'm not in control of.
Which aligns exactly with what I say to teachers all the time, which is the only person that we can control is ourselves, because there's, in the teaching world, there's a big kind of like misconception that we have to be controlling our students and controlling our classes, but it is physically impossible to control our students. You cannot control another human being. So the way that I like to think about it is exactly that. We can control ourselves. We can control the environment. We can control the lesson, like in terms of the preparation and what we're putting out there. But you can be the most prepared person. You can be the calmest person. You can be the person that's, you know, most able to co-regulate because you're so, you know, relaxed and all the rest of it. You can be in the best state ever, but those students are going to be doing their own thing, but we need to be the ones that are trying to influence and bringing them on board with that and creating the best environment that we possibly can. And that explains what you've just said, explains that so well for everybody that's listening. I love that so much.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I'm a psychotherapist. I've come to be with people who have had horrifying things happen to them and really have had so much privilege of having them share their stories with me, sometimes verbally, sometimes non-verbally. And it, I mean, it's just super clear to me that asking people to kind of relinquish their dysregulation or their sense of not being safe in the world, like, it is actually super disrespectful of me, right? That these folks who are holding inside their bodies and in their brains and in their nervous systems such dysregulation because of the intensity of what happened or in some circumstances didn't happen for them, it makes perfect sense that they have that level of intensity and level of dysregulation in their nervous system. Now, I know I come to be with kids in a wildly different way than educators do. Like, my literal job is to say to kids, like, bring your dysregulation to me. I want it to come here. And that's a kind of a privilege that I have in my, you know, capacity as a therapist. Also, though, it is how the neurobiology works. And so when I work with folks in other capacities, educators, parents, you know, folks who are saying, but I'm not a therapist. And I'm like, yes, I totally understand that. But this child's nervous system doesn't really care. Like, they're going to bring it to you. And our job isn't to stop it. Our job is to find a way that we can meet it with what it needs, which is safety and regulation.
And what you're saying is so accurate on so many levels, and it really highlights how incongruous our education system can be to what actually is needed for our young people. Yeah. And the fact that you said that us expecting a young person to be in our classroom doing exactly what we need to be doing, under control, all of those things, is a disrespectful, like I've never heard it be explained in that way before, and it just makes such perfect sense that it is disrespectful you to put your trauma on hold for me because I need something from you. I need to control you. I need this environment to be the way that I, you know, envision it to be. But it is so hard for teachers because they've got 30 kids in a room, obviously. Like, I've worked with the most complex needs kids on a different level to you. Have I been in the classroom with a lot of them? Yeah. It is so difficult, but it just highlights how important it is for us to be reimagining the way that we, and it's hard because we don't have the funding for it and all the rest. There's so many barriers in the way, but it just highlights how necessary it is for us to be reimagining the way that we work with these young people to be able to support them in a better way. Teachers aren't psychologists, but there are so many things that we can be implementing from what you're saying in the classroom. Felt safety can come from a variety of places. I think of felt safety as having continuity and predictability in the classroom through routines and structures and all of those things that we can be doing. We don't need to be trained in psychotherapy to be able to do that.
I completely agree. I had a mentor say a long time ago that, you know, really good therapists are just really good humans. Now, that's not a, there's not a value statement there as far as like good versus bad, but that what she was really attempting to convey is there's actually very little about what happens in the therapy setting that is unique to therapists, that there are some important, you know, therapeutic modalities and interventions that certainly we want to, you know, leave to the trained and licensed psychotherapists, but so much about, you know, creating healing experiences for people is not confined to the therapy room, right? Like, it's not something, in fact, I feel really strongly that a lot of us as psychotherapists hold a little bit too strongly to these tools as if they're ours. And wouldn't it be so much better if we said, oh, no, this is just about being human. And I also want to be really clear that I'm not judging anybody who wants to control an out of control, dysregulated child's behavior. I do too. In fact, I probably do more than even a lot of people. And that's why I've had to make this my job, right? Like, my life's work. I have to touch into that this often, you know, that I turn this into my career, because being with people in protection mode, being with kids in protection mode, puts us into protection mode.
Yeah.
And then all humans, when they shift into protection mode, shift into control. Oh,
they I was going to say the same thing. Yeah. Like, I'm in front of a class of 30 students. I feel out of control. I feel incredibly dysregulated.
Yes.
I need to get back into connection mode. And the way I can do that is to control things around me, because we need to regain that sense of control over the environment. And it's so hard to not flip into that. And, you know, I spent a lot of my career in that, and I still do sometimes, in that protection mode where I'm trying to kind of get the class. I don't do it as much now, but sometimes I find myself shifting into old patterns where I'm like, right, that's it. You know, like, it's so easy to fall back into those patterns when we ourselves are in protection mode, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's super easy. And also makes neurobiological sense. Like, this isn't a character flaw or a morality flaw. This is how the brain works. The more dysregulated we get, the more we're going to fall back into default old patterns and the less awareness we have of it. So it's just being perfectly human.
I read on your caption with the connection and protection post about the fact that you saw like a bathrobe tie and you jumped and it looked like a snake. And that's really stuck with me, because since having Ava, I think that I've been more in protection mode in the days where she's like going through a developmental leap or whatever, to the point where like sometimes I'll feel really dysregulated and she'll scratch the side of my, like, oh, she'll be feeding and she'll scratch the side of me and I'll immediately think it's a bug, where other days I won't think that and I'll just want to throw her off me. But some days I won't feel like that. So I guess that's the same like kind of response in the body, where I'm just really dysregulated and I'm a little bit hypersensitive to things.
That's such a great way to just remind us that this is, again, just about being human, that the kids that we work with, ourselves, for reasons that are sometimes obvious and sometimes not obvious, our nervous systems, our default could be tipped a little bit more towards not safe on any given day, on any given moment. So often we're like, there's no reason for this child to be like this. Like, well, there's a reason that's super obvious, but yeah. There is a reason. There's always a reason. Nice. And I don't know, sometimes I'm in a bad mood and really can't articulate why, or sometimes I'm extra grumpy or touchy or testy or snap more, right? At that kind of proverbial bug, which could be just my husband talking to me, right? And so I'm like, rawr! And some days it's obvious, like, oh, I didn't sleep well last night. But sometimes it's like, I don't know, I just feel off today. Yeah. And yeah, when we're kind of defaulting more into protection mode, we are going to interpret cues as dangerous. That, again, that's about staying alive. Like, if my nervous system is going to make a mistake about something being safe or not safe, I am going to err on the side of things being not safe, right? Because if I err on the side of something being safe and it ends up being not safe, that's a big problem, right? I mean, at the core here is we're always just trying to stay alive.
And I think that the students or the children who are most in that protection mode are survivors, and they've had to adapt to situations that, you know, we are privileged if we don't have a brain that has had to adapt to chronic stress and trauma in the way that they have had to. And so they've just become really good at protection and staying safe for themselves.
Yes. I love how you just said that too, that felt safety really truly is a privilege.
Yeah.
And those of us that are able to kind of cultivate it a little more often than others for a whole wide variety of reasons, I think privilege isn't something to feel guilty about. Privilege is something to just notice and then look at, okay, now how can I use this privilege to support folks who don't have it.
That's brilliant. I would love to hear more about your framework of the owls, the watchdogs, and the possums. Yeah. Is it the kind of similar to like the wise owl and the lizard and all of that kind of stuff? How would you explain that?
Sure. It is probably similar. I mean, I think there's only so many metaphors, right?
Yeah.
Understanding our brain, our body, and our nervous system. So there's lots of different kinds of overlaps. And I absolutely believe that whatever metaphor works for you, like, take that and run with it. None is, you know, there's not one that's more right than the other. In the work that I've done with kids, I've been just so lucky to listen, like, really, really intensely to what they're saying and how they're showing me the inner kind of their inner world. So the owl and the watchdog and possum metaphor have come from the way I've brought together the interpersonal neurobiology theories with polyvagal theory with Dr. Perry's neurosequential model of therapeutics. So at the most basic, the owl part of our nervous system is the part that emerges when we're feeling safe. From a polyvagal perspective, Dr. Porges talks about our ventral vagus, which is the part of our nervous system that is responsible for social engagement and connection and is responsible for behaviors that, again, are like inviting of connection, as well as like letting other people know that we're open and available for connection. It's also really important to remember that connection with ourselves is very valid, that not everybody based on temperament or all sorts of different things is always interested in being super connected to other people. So when I say this connection side of their nervous system, I'm not preferencing people who are maybe a little more extroverted or, you know, enjoy more social interactions. Not a connection is about like being connected to ourselves and open and available for connection, like to others in the world.
So when you say the word, sorry to interrupt, do you mean as well then if they're in connection mode in that sense, they're more likely to then be able to connect with their learning, to be able to connect with things that they enjoy doing and all of those kinds of things?
Absolutely. Those are all characteristics of being in a connection mode, being in the owl brain. It's being open and available and receptive, mindful and present of ourselves and other people. Of course, all age appropriately, right? Like how a 4-year-old does this and how a 17-year-old does this, very, very different. So from Dr. Porges's perspective, again, this is kind of when that ventral vagus is engaged, which happens when we're neuroceiving safety. So sometimes people can confuse the owl brain with like, it's calm and ready for learning and taking math tests. Maybe, but the owl brain is very adaptable, right? The owl brain is, you know, what's happening in my environment with me and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And, you know, am I connected to myself? And then therefore open and available to being connected to others. Once then the nervous system starts to neuroceive some danger, it shifts into protection mode. There's two pathways, sympathetic activation, fight or flight, and then the dorsal vagal collapse. So that's, again, Porges's language. So we have these two pathways of defensive protective behavior. Either we get a lot of extra energy and we fight flight. We have energy in our arms and our legs and sometimes our mouths, right? Or yelling and screaming or being sassy or disrespectful or defiant, right? That's one
Lucky
pathway.
By me.
Speaking from experience. So that's one pathway. And then the other pathway in protection mode is what Porges calls the dorsal vagal pathway. Dr. Perry talks about the dissociation pathway. I call that the possum pathway. So it's a collapse. It's a bringing in of energy. So in the sympathetic pathway, which I call the watchdog pathway, all of the energy is in our arms and our legs, right? So we can run away or we can fight and it's extra energy and our hearts are beating faster and our lungs are breathing faster. There's more. On the possum pathway, there's a significant decrease of energy and all of our energy actually leaves our limbs, comes into our torso, our viscera, and then there's a huge decrease in energy. We tend to take a collapsed posture of like eyes down, chin down. We are often protecting our head or our torso in some way, like our arms often wrap around our torso or our head. Sometimes if we're like on the ground or even in a chair, like our legs come into our torso too, right? So like our knees are up and we could maybe even rest our head on our knees. And if we look at that, all of that posturing is about protecting our head and our viscera, which are parts of our bodies we could not live without, right? Like if I'm, you know, under attack and my arm gets ripped off, I could survive. But I cannot survive, right? Like my guts being kind of tore into or something tragic happening with my head. So all of that energy decreases. Our heart rate really slows. Our respiration really slows. Again, that's kind of this last ditch attempt at survival in case there is an injury. But it also is a way that our body begins to kind of really disconnect from the experience that's happening. We release some like neurochemicals and hormones that help us not hurt near as badly. So all of that kind of starts to happen on the possum pathway. So that then is the whole model. The owl pathway is when I'm feeling safe and connected. And, you know, sometimes the owl has a little extra energy and it's a playful owl. And sometimes the owl has, you know, a big decrease in energy. And that's an owl that's like snuggling on the couch or like getting ready for bed, right? But all of that is about feeling safe and connected. And then on the watchdog pathway, it's I'm not safe. I've got extra energy. And there's four different levels of watchdogs depending on the level of feeling unsafe. And then the possum pathway is this big decrease, collapse, shutdown. And again, there's four levels of possum depending on how unsafe the possum feels.
Usually, the whole idea of fight, flight, and freeze gets mushed together. don't yeah. they, as one response. Hearing you talk about the two different pathways makes complete sense to begin with, but it also kind of like in my head right now, because I'm a very visual thinker and a visual learner, the way that you just described that has completely kind of flipped the visual that I have of the stress response in my mind and kind of given me a new way of looking at it, which is amazing. And I appreciate that so much because I love coming at it from different angles. It just makes so much sense. Do you think that people are geared more towards the possum or to the guard, like the watchdog? Or do you think that it's like different, just different circumstances? Or
I think it really depends on what that person's previous, you know, experiences were and what pathway was exercised most, right? So we know things like neurons that fire together, wire together, like the more you exercise a certain pathway in the brain, whether that is like the play the piano pathway or the, you know, collapse shut down pathway, the more you exercise that pathway, the more likely you are to take that pathway in the future. Dr. Perry does a really great job of talking about how you can, your the stress response system gets overly sensitized. And then based on your neuroception and based on the cues and clues that you're getting from the environment, your neuroception's making this, like, you know, in a less than a quarter of a second decision, like which one, based on all of my previous experiences, is the safest, best choice in the moment? Is it to have a watchdog response or a possum response? So some of that depends on, you know, if we're looking at some, again, my area of expertise is complex trauma. So if, you know, I'm working with a child and I know that their earliest months were terrifying, it's possible that that child's going to have actually kind of an over-exercised possum pathway, because newborn babies don't have a fight response much, right? Like they can't, they can cry and have a lot of energy to like kind of shake and move around their arms and legs.
They can't get away.
Yeah, they can't get away.
Yeah. Yeah, they can't fight against it.
Quickly, newborn babies and young babies will go to the possum pathway because it's much safer and it's more accessible, right? So I tend to see different like pathways that are preferenced based on what is that person's history. There's also some evidence that suggests folks who are raised and socialized female tend to go possum more than folks who are raised and socialized male tend to, you know, go more watchdog. All of this really just validates how complex our neuroception is. Like our neuroception is taking in 11 million bits of data in every moment and using all of that data to decide safe or not safe. If not safe, how unsafe? Like, am I unsafe enough where, you know, I could run or fight? And based on my history, do I think that's a reasonable choice? Or am I so unsafe, it would be better to collapse? And better on my history, that, you know, based on my history, that makes a more reasonable choice. So it's just really complex.
I guess like with neuroplasticity as well, can we shift away from those? I guess you can, obviously, can't you? Like if you're more geared towards a possum response, we can kind of, through neuroplasticity, all those points of connection start to rewire the brain to not see things as a threat and all of those types of things, can't we?
Absolutely. We can. What I say is we can work really hard to grow our owl brain. And so if we can have the kinds of experiences we need to really essentially, I mean, physiologically, what we're doing is strengthening this part of our nervous system that's our ventral vagus. And we really can strengthen and myelinate our ventral vagus so that our nervous system can spend more time in the unique part of our experience where we're being curious. Right. The part where it's like, huh, I think something might not be right here, but let me pause and take in more information before I actually decide. And so we can do a lot in a lot of various kinds of ways to really strengthen. And I, in my model, I just say we're really going to work on strengthening our owl brains. Mm-hmm. And that's for kids and for grownups. So that the owl brain can stay more in charge and work more collaboratively with the watchdog or the possum brain. It's the watchdog and the possum brain is not the problem. The problem is that they're overestimating the danger than what
because they've
really
had
is.
To their whole yeah, like exactly. the whole life of that individual. They've had to be on high alert exactly. and they've had to be hyperactive with it.
Yes, they're super sensitive. They just have really yeah. sensitive watchdog brains or really sensitive yeah. possum brains. And so as a therapist, what I know to be true is we cannot shame the parts of us that hold our watchdog brain or the parts of us that hold our possum brain. We'll never heal if we come at it from a negative shaming perspective. So we really have to work towards having a lot of compassion and gratitude for the watchdog and the possum brain. And I actually have found that kind of anthropomorphizing these parts yeah. of us is helpful. Like we can it allows us to have a little distance. And then that distance allows us to see the watchdog brain as exactly what watchdogs are, which are afraid and working really, really hard to keep them and their owners safe. The same with possums. They're just really, really, really afraid. And we also don't want them to go away. Like if I didn't have a watchdog brain, that would be terrible. Mm. Like I really need my watchdog brain to help me make safe choices and to help me respond in an emergency. So we're not trying to get rid of these parts of the nervous system. We're trying to really strengthen our owl brain so that the watchdog and the possum brain can kind of feel more supported by the owl brain and more willing to check in with the owl and trust the owl, right? Like, am I safe? Am I not safe?
Do you think even through the act of children understanding the roles of these parts of the brain, it does help to give that more curious space as you were talking about? Because I always, when I'm teaching teachers about this stuff and I'm nowhere near as knowledgeable as you are, I know the very basics to be able to get through kind of talking to teachers and training teachers. But teaching students about the owl brain and what I call, you know, the parts of the brain,
yep.
you know, the guard dog, same kind of concept. When I teach students about that, or when I get teachers to teach students about that, I feel like even them being able to be analytical, because analyzing is a part of the, you know, the owl brain, isn't it? Like the space yep. to be able to do that, being connected, that helps them in the moment to stop and go, oh, okay, something's happening here. Something in my body's happening. I can recognize a physiological response or something, you know, I find that even them kind of having an awareness of it helps to start to strengthen that connection.
Absolutely. The owl brain has awareness. The watchdog and the possum brain, for great like physiological reasons, don't have a lot of self-awareness. They're not supposed to. Owls and possums, or I mean, watchdogs and possums are supposed to just stay alive. They're not supposed to be self-reflective. Owls are self-reflective. So exactly. And there's research that really supports this. Again, regardless of the metaphor or, you know, what, even not using a metaphor, like actually learning about the prefrontal cortex and your ventral vagus nerve mm-hmm. and your insular, you know, like it doesn't have to be metaphor, but regardless of the approach we take, learning about our like neural processes strengthens the owl brain. It grows our capacity for self-reflection and is step number one, really, yes. in beginning to feel like we have some power. I mean, if I feel like my nervous system has a mind of its own, it does whatever it wants, and I can't do anything to be in charge of it, I'm not going to try to, right? So believing and understanding what the actual inner workings are and what the actual neural processes are begins to kind of empower me to feel like, oh, I could do something about this. And then, yes, the very act of self-reflection, the very act of noticing, and the act of being compassionate. So looking at these challenging behaviors that are getting us in a lot of trouble, looking at those behaviors as, oh, my watchdog brain is just too excited or my watchdog brain is just making a big mistake, right? Like it's wanting to help me. So it really, truly, when we look at it neurobiologically, that the part of compassion is crucial. And so in my work then with kids, like I have watched that just come alive in the therapy room, how they can start to be with these different parts of themselves, separate from them, offer compassion to those parts of themselves, then that owl part of their nervous system just gets stronger and stronger and stronger.
That's brilliant. And I think that teachers thinking about the concept of that as well allows them to have more compassion for themselves as teachers and the way they're responding in the classroom, but also the students who are the ones who are causing massive disruption. It can be so hard for us to look at a student and go, I feel compassion for you, when they are single-handedly, you know, derailing a lesson, all of the work that we've done. It's very hard to then show that child compassion. And it's easy to say, oh, well, that's your fault. And, you know, you have to control yourself and rah, rah, all those things. But I think once we have an awareness of what is happening in their minds, it's far easier to then also keep ourselves in connection mode because we have compassion for others and ourselves. We're all just, I always just say we're all humans, just kind of trying to get through this messy life together, whether we're teachers, we're, you know, we're partners, like whatever we are, whatever situation, we're all just trying to get through whatever we're in that moment.
Yeah. So we often are afraid of compassion because so many of us, because of our own childhood experiences, have come to believe that compassion is somehow synonymous with just like giving up or excusing bad behavior. It's actually not at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, the exact opposite is true, that true compassion is associated with being able to set better boundaries. Mm-hmm. So having compassion for kids or their parents is not about saying, well, I'm just excusing or tolerating or going to have to figure out a way to be okay with their behavior. That's not it at all. Compassion actually lets us, just like you said, stay more in our owl brain. Then we can, one, be offering more safety, connection, and co-regulation to the child. That's always good. But we can use our owl brain to think better about how do I set a boundary here? Boundaries set from the owl brain versus boundaries set from the watchdog or the possum brain are much stickier, much easier to enforce. So compassion doesn't lead us to just excuse and tolerate bad behavior. It's the opposite.
And it also allows us as teachers to choose strategies for behavior management or classroom management that actually work to shift students out of these particular behaviors and into behaviors that are more productive for a classroom environment. So it is the opposite of excusing. I think it empowers students, it empowers teachers, and is the opposite of what some teachers think of when they think of a restorative approach, a trauma-informed approach, whatever you want to talk about when you're talking about teaching. You mentioned parents.
Yes.
And I did want to talk to you about this. In the work that I do, one of the things that is constantly coming up and constantly coming up from teachers is the work they do with their parents of the students, of like, you know, the parents of students is incredibly challenging.
Yep.
I always talk about the fact that parents have their own experiences of education. They're bringing their own, you know, things to the table, their own trauma to the table, their own, you know, mistrust of teachers or the education system and all the rest of it. And I saw you say once, if we want to help our kids, we have to love their parents. And then you said, it's not hard, I promise. A lot of teachers would beg to differ. They would say, it is hard, it is hard. Can you explain that a little bit more? Because I think that insight would be really supportive of teachers moving into a new academic year, especially.
Yeah. So same with child therapists, right? We come into this field because we love kids. And then we realize that we have to work with our parents. And we're I'm not so sure about this after all. I just taught a workshop and I was like, working with the kids is the easy part. It's working with their parents that is really challenging. And that there's
isn't it funny that like teachers say the same thing?
Yeah. Yes. Whole host of reasons for that. And so I don't want to minimize that, that like yes. as a therapist also, I totally get that. But some of it's just our temperaments, right? Like teachers, child therapists, like we love kids, you know, like kids make a lot of sense to me. It's much, much, much easier to see their behavior through this lens than it is for me to see adult behavior through this lens. The reason I say it doesn't have to be hard is because the exact same theory that lets us love the kids and see their behavior for what it really is applies to their parents. We don't have to learn anything new. Parents have the same nervous system, connection mode, protection mode. Parents are older, and so they've had a lot more experiences in their life that have let those pathways be a lot stickier, right? Like their brains need way more new experiences to shift than kids do, simply because they're older, right? But the exact same theory applies, that when I am working with parents, and working with parents who are, you know, what we would call resistant or oppositional or blaming their kid or blaming me or refusing to even meet with me or whatever behavior that we're going to label as resistant, actually, all we need to do is label that as coming from the protective side of the nervous system. It's a watchdog behavior, or it's a possum behavior. Now, in our role as a child therapist or as teachers, we have very little power to shift that, right? That's not what our job is exactly. But just seeing parents through that lens changes everything for me. Like it completely changes how I'm with that parent, how I'm interpreting their behavior. And the reason that matters is because that then changes me, right? Like I can stay in connection mode, which means I'm still labeling this behavior as inappropriate or unacceptable or whatever the truth is. But I'm not judging them. I'm not judging me, right? Because I don't know if this is true for educators, it's for therapists, but therapists are real quick to fall into the, oh, this is all my fault. I must be really terrible at this. I have no idea what I'm doing. I should quit my job. So I work with therapists around like not making meaning out of parent behavior beyond this parent's in protection mode.
Yeah.
Then we can go like, what are things I could do about that? And actually, there are a lot of things I could do to help parents feel safer in their interactions with me. Lots. Also, when it comes right down to it, I'm not their therapist or, you know, I'm not their, you know, whatever. Like if you're the teacher, like some of that, I just have to say outside of my power, outside of my control, but it still changes what I think about them, how I feel about them, how I approach them. Ultimately, then that means it changes how I feel. I'm not carrying around near the same amount of like stress or protection mode in my own nervous system. That changes my job satisfaction. That decreases my burnout, you know, increases my ability to stay in connection mode when I'm at work and at home. So even if I can't change parent behavior, which we can't, so let's just all just agree we can't do that any more than we can change the children's behavior. Mm-hmm. It's just us. And that really matters.
And that's exactly what I say to teachers who are struggling with challenging parental interactions. You can't change that parent. All you can do is respond to them with, and I say to them, with compassion, because you don't know what that parent's background is. The only way that, because I know you talk about a lot about co-regulation as well. The only way that we can have a positive interaction with that parent is by remaining calm ourselves, and us raising to that level isn't going to help the situation. So we just have to remain compassionate, calm, connected. That's all we can do with the parents and try. Like, I like to see it as we're all just trying to do the best for that child, even if we don't understand the way they're approaching it, even though the way they're approaching it maybe isn't the way that we would approach it with our young person. they're trying their best. And that's kind of the way that I try to get teachers to see it differently with parents. But what you're saying is exactly right. Like, I understand now why all of your work is based around this idea of connection and protection, because it just makes sense for everybody, doesn't it?
It really does. And again, sometimes people will talk about, like, well, how do we know if this theory is true or not? And this might sound terrible to say out loud, but there's a part of me that doesn't really even care, because yeah, the theory has shifted everything about my being with myself. I had a colleague recently say to me, like, anything that increases our capacity to be with others and ourselves with more compassion, total win. Total win. And this does shift helps things
with children as well. Yeah. Like, it's proven to make immense change with children. Like, of course it does.
100%. And it really isn't even about changing their behavior, though. I want other people's bad behavior to change just as much as the rest of us do. I mean, it makes life a lot easier. But ultimately, that's not really even what it's about. What it's really about is, you know, creating a world where there's more safety for people.
That's beautiful. And like, if we can make our classrooms even a little bit safer for young people who have had all of that complex trauma, like, I almost cried when you spoke about the newborn and the protection. Like, I think I'm really hormonal because of my own baby and she's still quite young. God, I'm going to get all teary. But like, hearing you talk about that, you have to go back and think about these students or these children as babies. And, you know, what have they gone through? What are their experiences? Everybody around us has got a story, don't they? And if we can bring more compassion into the world, if we can understand each other on a human level, and behaviors are behaviors, but they're telling a story, aren't they? So just holding compassion for ourselves and for others. I mean, my behaviors in the past haven't been too great. And I was looking back now as a rational kind of, like, you know, I'm in my owl brain more now, but looking back, I was in protection mode 24/7 and I have compassion for myself. And the more we can do that for ourselves and others, you're right, the world will be a much better place. And that's like, I feel like that's ending things on a really airy fairy note, but it is so incredibly true. Robin, you are just, you're amazing and you're such a wealth of knowledge. So just, yeah, tell me where I can find more from you, where everyone can find more of your work. Tell me about your book.
Yes, I'd love to. I do have so many ways that people can access this work, and a lot of it's free. So I have a podcast. It's called The Baffling Behavior Show. So of course that's free. Over on my website, I have a free resources page that's like ebooks, webinars, downloadables, infographics. I mean, just tons and tons of free resources. Even on my social media, like on Facebook, I'm Robin Goble MSW, and on Instagram, I'm robin.goble. You know, the carousels and the images, like, I've just worked so hard to create lots of access for folks to be able to learn about their own nervous system and their kids' nervous system.
You've done a brilliant job, by the way, because your Instagram, your resources are fantastic. And I would urge anybody to go over there and check them out, because they are so accessible, so brilliant. They're simple enough for anybody to kind of understand. If you're a parent who doesn't really understand this stuff just yet and has like a really base understanding, but then, like, it's just so complex and it's so amazing, the work that you do and the kind of the access that you give into that world.
Yeah. I mean, it was something I didn't, you know, like, so many of us, we only learn about ourselves because of how people reflect to us, you know, our own truth. And so for a long time, I didn't even realize that this was kind of a unique skill. But according to other people, my ability to translate the science is unique. And so I've sort of, and it's fun. I mean, it's so fun. So I have so much that is totally free. There's no, you know, barrier to any of it. In September, my first book is coming out. That's Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors: Brain, Body, Sensory Strategies That Really Work. It's the world's longest book title. that comes out September 21st.
Amazing.
You can get that anywhere. And then I offer two programs. One is for parents It's a virtual community. I call it a virtual community of connection, co-regulation, and a little education. And so that's a paid membership program for parents of kids with big baffling behaviors, vulnerable nervous systems. And then I have a training program for professionals. So it's a year-long immersive training program for professionals who really want to grow their capacity to be with the most dysregulated kids and families. Usually the people who come to me, they're like, oh, the easy ones are easy. I don't need to. Like, I know the tools, people say. What I struggle with is staying regulated enough to use these tools with the most dysregulated, you know, parents and kids. So that's why my program is a year long, because the professionals who come to me, they don't just need tools. They really need to grow their own like window of tolerance and their own capacity for being with families with this level of intensity. So it's this very immersive, highly intensive program. And then those graduates also earn the licensing rights to teach my materials. So they get my PowerPoints and my parent course and all my worksheets, and they can use that in their community or with their clients.
You do a lot. So all of the things that you've just discussed, I'm obviously going to put in my show notes so everybody can access that, find you, you know, get all of the stuff, all the goods from you. Really hope that all of you who are listening have appreciated all of the knowledge and expertise that Robin has brought today. You do give her a follow, whether you're a teacher or not, whether you're a parent. I think it's really applicable for any human being, as we just said before. So thank you so much, Robin. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And thank you to all of your listeners. I'm a therapist. I like kids one at a time. You can't imagine being in front of 30. And I only go and talk to educators when I'm invited, because I don't like to stand up in front of educators and act like I have any idea what I would do with 30 out of control children. So I hope it was really I happen to know a little bit about the science, but y'all are who know how to be with classrooms. And so if there's anything about the science that I, you know, can offer and you can just weave it into your brilliance and expertise, that's what I hope for. So thank you to all the educators and to you too.
Thank you, Robin.